Paper Mate, are you alive?
Yep, alive and kicking.
What's going on, buddy? What's going on?
The usual, just, you know, shut in and locked out. So at the same time.
This is like our third episode. We're doing it over like this Zoom conferencing app, which is a super cool feature and way that we can leverage to still like continue to push out content, which I appreciate. Yeah.
Well, how from what I understand, we'll be doing this quite a few more times. I think this is going to last a while.
Yeah, my job said May 1st is the day we'll come back. And then I got an email. They pushed it back to May 15th. So that's like another month from now.
Yeah. Good for you. I'm looking at June or July before I start seeing patients in person again. So,
Better. How have you been spending your time?
Honestly, I've been doing like a lot of work, a lot of schoolwork, and working from home. But I recently picked up learning how to fight again, like sparring and stuff.
Oh, okay. Thunder. What type of fighting?
I think it's more of boxing, like a kind of kickboxing.
Yo, she's low-key telling me not to fuck with her in a few weeks.
You know.
I have a few more weeks to act out of line and that's it. She's taking
yes,
over.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Right, while the distance is here.
But I did
put
run
some
into
respect
this
on my name.
Well, for me, I did run into this post and I think it's good enough that I'm willing to share. So if you Google online learning at Harvard, there's a bunch of courses that they'll provide for free. And they're usually like 6 to 8 weeks. And it's a whole bunch of different subjects that they'll cover. Classes like introduction to game development, mobile app development, intro to artificial intelligence, health and medicine. Like it's a whole class for like solutions if you have like back pain. But there's like 140 of these. And they're all about 6 to 8 weeks in length. And they're free. I think...
Oh, they're free. That was going to be my next question.
Yeah. Oh, no. I wouldn't even talk about it. I don't got Harvard money out here. But all right. So they're free. F-R-E-E-F-F, five-finger discount. And they're 6 to 8 weeks long. And you can go at your own pace. And I'm just telling you what I know because I haven't actually started yet. I'll probably start today or tomorrow. So when you fuck me up, next time you see me, I'm going to take that back pain class too by then. So,
that'd be smart.
Anyway, all right, you want to start the show?
Yeah, let's start it.
Let's do it.
Black Hypothesis.
I met a new friend who literally has the same major I do. He'd be so interesting to speak with. AR, how are you doing today?
Hey, Paper Man. I'm doing good today. How are you guys doing on this beautiful quarantine Saturday?
We're doing okay. AR is an environmental health and safety program systems administrator and data analyst. So I figured, let's speak with him. Who better to have this conversation with about environmental health, environmental sciences, and how it impacts the Black community? He's had quite a bit of experience in that. And also, he's planning on furthering his education in the sciences. So
that's dope.
Yeah, I'm hoping that AR, you'll be able to help us just enlighten everyone on how we can get involved in this kind of program, in this kind of world, in learning more about this type of science.
Yeah, definitely.
So AR, so you're currently working in environmental health. What got you started in this type of field?
Hey, so I started off coming out of high school. I was, son of immigrant parents. Or just one, actually, from East
Ooh,
Africa.
Immigrant parents from what country?
Eritrea. My dad's Black American.
Motherland.
Right. anyways, as a lot of immigrant parents want for their kids, medical school was the direction, right? So I was in college. I was pre-med, science major. All the hard classes, chemistry, physics, biology, that are required to get admitted in medical school. And while I was volunteering at a hospital, you know, I was seeing a lot of people coming in for issues that were seemingly preventive and due to largely environmental factors. So I shortly after changed my major to environmental science before I graduated. You know, I thought from there, you know, I wasn't able to find a job straight out of college, but I was passionate about youth outreach. So I did AmeriCorps for a year, City Air AmeriCorps. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Lancaster did that too.
Yeah,
I thought I heard that. So I did that for a year. Then I started working at my local health department. I was an environmental health specialist for the state of Maryland. From there, I worked as a health inspector, inspecting food service safety, water quality, waste and septic disposal and permitting, you know, some zoonosis cases, incident cases. And so working as an environmental health specialist at a local health department, you do get to see or be on the forefront of a lot of, you know, community health issues as it pertains to environmental health and safety. And then recently, within the past month, I found a job, or no, in the past few months, I found a job with a defense contractor that did environmental consulting for, you know, a lot of Department of Defense and commercial clients. And I work with their environmental health and safety program, basically making sure that, you know, the workers aren't exposed to any occupational health and safety risks. And I'm also kind of in a transitional part of my career, trying to get more into the data science and the artificial intelligence and data analytics side of things. So I'm actually just admitted into graduate school for computational and applied mathematics. And from there, I'm going to become the plan is to become a data scientist that specializes in environmental health and safety fields.
Wow. What a trail. There was so much in there. Like, yeah. That's very impressive.
I got a question for you. So you mentioned water quality at one of your other jobs. And yeah. I just piqued my interest because I live in a town where the water quality is trash. I'm not going to say the name of it. How do you evaluate water quality? Like, what are the testing methods that you guys use, and what are the like thresholds that you guys were looking for to say, all right, this is safe? And like, what are you actually testing for?
Specifically, it's a bacteria called coliform, and it's bacteria that grows in very polluted waters. And so I'm not a specialist. I wish I could give you a more extensive or expansive explanation on testing for water quality, because as a local environmental health specialist, I would go to a local house. I would take a water sample and I would do some very preliminary testing. I would check for the pH. You can get a water testing kit, the same water testing kit that you would use for a pool safety kit. You can use to at least do some preliminary water testing, at least for the pH and for the chlorine content. And so that's something that is required in any developed world for any safe water to drink. The pH and the chlorine content.
Okay.
Concentration. And so, you know, and it sounds crazy because sometimes some people, they'll smell their faucet water and it'll have like a faint bleach scent. Mm-hmm. And they'll get worried. But actually that's something that's supposed to be something to indicate that your water is actually safer than it would have been otherwise. Just because, mm-hmm. you know, it's being treated, and the chlorine, it's used to kill a lot of the bacteria. And, you know, so we check the pH and the chlorine content. Then from there, we would send it back to our state testing laboratory, and they would do a lot more extensive testing, which, you know, you'd have to have very strong, basically a microbiologist would test it. And then they'd send the report back. And, you know, ideally you want to see that they have what's called the coliform count of zero. If it's at one or higher than that, then it's too much. It means that there's the coliform is detectable, and that there might be, you know, bacteria in it. In terms of like metal pollutants and things like lead and whatnot, like that's tested for at Flint. I believe that's something that you either would have to get some kind of private company to do, or a lot of that other water testing, I believe, is done at municipal water facilities, you know, with your local city and state government. So from there, that's something I never had a background into. But, you know, that's the thing about environmental health sciences. It's a very broad field. And so like your knowledge and your expertise will be very much so like what you studied and what you worked in for your role to know, like, I guess what happens on that end.
Yeah. I'd say that I agree with that because there are just so many different aspects to what's required to, one, evaluate, two, test, three, develop whatever plans there can be to intervene. And there are people necessary, like, all along that track of planning and science evaluation that have different roles and different expertise. So definitely public health and environmental health have just an array of required fields to really get the job done. I also wanted to go back to AmeriCorps because that was what you opened with. I want to know how did you get involved in AmeriCorps in a way that you thought would benefit you?
Yeah, I went to work at a school and, you know, I was living in the local suburbs outside of DC, but I ended up, or the DMV as we call it, DC, Maryland, Virginia area. But yeah, you know, I went to work at a school in DC in Northeast, and with AmeriCorps, they have something that was called a service year. So AmeriCorps is a large conglomerate organization funded largely, but not completely by the federal government. And from there, they have a bunch of sub organizations, one of which is called City Year. And that's what I did. You know, a lot of people, they'll take the chance to do a gap year to do their service year. And they'll go, depending on what AmeriCorps program that they have isn't as available, like anywhere in the country. And it's tough because it's like, they really don't pay you much at all. It's below minimum wage. But you're a volunteer and you're not, you know, a salaried employee. So, you know, you're doing it so that you can offer some very critical and in need services for a community. So they have one thing called like FEMA Corps, which you're responding to environmental disasters. Mm-hmm. But I was part of City Year, and it's in cities all over. So I didn't feel the need to go away. I just do it in my local town. You know, wherever you're at, chances are there's an under-resourced community that could use whatever support there was. And it was a good opportunity. I enjoyed it.
Did it influence your career path?
Yes. It always helps to be able to frame and look at the world and your career as an educator. And so as when I was a health, I wouldn't say it influenced what I was trying to do with my career and my life, but it fortified it in some ways, you know, just giving me a deeper understanding and look at like the state of education and things that kind of need some addressing if we're to improve the state of STEM education in America and address these things like environmental health sciences and all these pressing issues that come with climate change and our changing population.
I think that when it comes to medicine, when it comes to health, a lot of the times the kind of exposure that we need or that is required for us to do good work can come from that kind of social impact and exposure, because it's a better way to understand the people you're working with and for. I think there's so many times that patients will come in and just to be able to connect with them, you really kind of need that understanding, kind of have to be able to gather information from people socially in order to do your job well, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Although I didn't go on to work as an environmental health practitioner or professional in the community that I did my AmeriCorps year in, I think that's very true, especially with doctors in medicine. You know, for so long, there's kind of been a concentration in just pulling people who are just experts in the natural sciences. But we're now seeing what I've heard, like for the MCAT and whatnot, that, you know, they want people to have a more, you know, social sciences, you know, psychological, but, you know, definitely a more humanist approach in the way that they're more interpersonal and that they know how to engage people from different backgrounds and whatnot. I feel like AmeriCorps really helped for that. But in terms of, yeah, the career that I'm working as an environmental health practitioner and the technical side of things and a lot of the natural science knowledge that I need to know, honestly, no, it didn't contribute for that.
Why do you say that? Why do you say it didn't contribute?
I mean, because, you know, if I was working in, let's say, FEMA Corps, where it was an environmental program where you actually are, you know, learning these federal regulations to help for emergency and environmental disasters, then, yeah, I would say like that skill set, at least that hard skill set, is more aligned with being an environmental health practitioner. But working in a school as an AmeriCorps member, you know, I wouldn't say I learned any hard skills from that, but I did learn a lot of soft skills. And that's where I said, like, learning to view the world as an educator and just, you know, learning how to level with the people that you're working with, learning how to, you know, even just do conflict resolution and mm-hmm. you know, or in trying to understand the backgrounds that different people can come from and why it influences their decisions to do some of the things that they're doing. Especially like when I was an environmental health specialist as a regulator, you know, I used to have to do a lot of food service restaurant inspections. And, you know, a lot of it was trying to educate people on regulations, but a lot of people, there were a lot of regulations that they, you know, felt that they didn't need to, or they just kept forgetting, you know, and it was kind of like working, you know, sometimes with the student, you know, because at the end of the day, we're all people trying to learn and do our jobs better than we were the day before. And so like, you know, just being able to know, you know, when to, how to break down certain, you know, silos of issues and learning how to chip away and start, you know, it's kind of like trying to help a student learn, you know, the questions or the different issues or the different parts or aspects of a problem that they're having for a math equation and for a test that they have the next day. So, you know, it's very abstract in that sense. Obviously, you know, it might sound like I'm stretching a little, but...
No, I don't think you're stretching at all. I think that's exactly right.
I would say that when I did it a long time ago, I definitely felt like I learned the importance of social responsibility and accountability and knowing that you don't live in a vacuum. And even though some people do may live on the other side, once you do get to know them, you get to see that they're not that much more different from you. And you also learn the importance of just being able to teach people the importance of community and social responsibility, like I said, and just education as well. And you get to see how just important it is and how much of a difference it can make in someone's life, especially when they're young. Because I worked in elementary school. I don't know if you was in middle school, elementary school.
I was elementary too. But
elementary, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you really get to see like how important it is as an adult, the type of factors that can make a huge difference in a kid's life. One of them being environmental and social political and things like that. But just in terms of like environmental factors only, like my school, it was in the hood. It was in the hood by the highway. I think there was a factory a couple blocks down.
Same here.
2 out of 5 days during the summer, it was like filled with smog. They definitely played outside and everything because you need to let them go out and research. But yeah. And like the way where I live in the town that I live, I'm like surrounded by an incinerator and highways and the airport, a whole bunch of industrial stuff, right? And
yeah,
a lot of places where there's more like black people. Like even if you go in the South, they'll put all these big like industrial farms in places where there's more black people and stuff like that. So I guess that'll lead me to my question. Would you say minorities as a whole are exposed to environmental factors that negatively impact their health and safety disproportionately to like white people or other or non-black people?
Yeah, of course. You know, there's a whole lot of data on that, you know, from countless universities. And I think even like the EPA and the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health and the CDC, they all, you know, they're gathering data on this. Like you said, there are a lot of, I believe what's called environmental racism and environmental justice issues where, you know, a lot of schools, especially and historically, not just schools, but yeah, entire communities, they got hit with redlining and the environmental implications of that, you know, are resounding to this day. You know, with the redlining, the Department of Transportation tended to send a lot of, you know, highways just right through neighborhoods, you know, just slashing their property values and, you know, worse off, exposing them to a lot of noise pollution and smog pollution and just terrible air quality conditions that hit their community hard along with everything else, you know, the crack epidemic in the 80s and whatnot. It kind of already put a lot to their plate as they were dealing with. And to this day, you know, a lot of, you know, buildings, like, you know, they're still, you know, built with lead pipes or, you know, asbestos in their walls and or lead paint and things of that nature that, you know, that they're dealing with in Philadelphia, to, you know, DC, Baltimore. They, a lot of schools in the neighborhoods are still, you know, in addition to having that substandard, you know, housing and building materials, you know, they're right outside. They tend to be a lot outside of a lot of factories and pollution centers. You know, even like in DC, I think two of our garbage and disposal trucks routes, they have the large trash processing factories right next to black neighborhoods in Northwest DC. And the funny thing about that is there's not even a lot of if you know DC, like Northwest, it does have black neighborhoods, but like portionally speaking, a lot of the black community in DC is concentrated in Northeast and Southeast. They have trash processing facilities in Northwest DC, and still they happen to be with like in their historically black communities, you know? So it's like, it's the same shit, different day, but it requires people to get politically, I mean, obviously educated, but politically involved, and especially, it can't be stressed enough, you know, vote for politicians that believe in science and also believe in the social science of racial and socioeconomic inequities that exist in our country. Yeah. And, yeah. You know, hopefully there'll be some progress from that, you know, but the tough reality of being black in America, you know, is just,
Statistically, incinerators, highways, and such tend to be more concentrated in these areas where most that are majority minority populated. And the residents obviously have negative health outcomes due to the density of the high pollutants in their communities. And that resulted in like a really high incidence of asthma and childhood asthma. It resulted in hospitalizations and a lot of deaths, but we don't really see the kind of like policy that will regulate or change the outcomes. It seems to be more difficult for these communities to get that enacted.
I agree.
Is there a route that people can take through college or education to get in those areas and in those rooms where they can start to have like political science? I think that's where politicians come from, right? They're probably political science. Is there like an environmental section of political science in schools?
Yeah, definitely. There are concentrations within a lot of different school programs and majors at the undergrad and graduate level. But like in terms of like policy, you know, in law, like there's so many routes, there's so many careers, there's so many school programs. I wouldn't say it's a stretch to say you can kind of get into it regardless of any point in your career or background academically, you know, into trying to work in, you know, environmental science and policy. Because, I mean, when you think about it, there's almost an environmental aspect, or no, an environmental application. It's almost any major you can think of. Like, for example, I know, like, if you want to talk about the school programs particularly, like, I remember at my university, like, I was in my school's natural and agricultural sciences. I was in my college, my university's natural science college. I was an environmental science major, and they had a lot of natural science concentrations. But the social science school, they had a social science concentration of environmental science. The school of public policy, you know, they also had an environmental concentration, and schools of public health also tend to have a communications concentration. But there are a lot of people who they come from any background and they'll go to law school and, you know, specialize in environmental law. And that's when, you know, it really doesn't matter what major you come from, because, you know, even if like you're an engineer, you know, a lot of electrical engineering grids, you know, that directly ties into environmental sustainability and energy use and pollution. Same with mechanical engineering. You know, there's environmental psychology. There's so many, you know, like I said, environmental applications of almost any major or field that you can think of.
Environmental engineering. Yeah.
You know, obviously that's an environmental major, you know, but like a major that people wouldn't consider is necessarily environmental, like English, right? You know, there's all types of journalists and you know, communication experts at nonprofit organizations, you know, government agencies, in just workplaces and careers that, you know, are these policy places where they need someone in that room. And it really can be any major or background. You don't even necessarily need to go to or major in a specific concentration that dictates environmental. You know, it's funny, and also I got to go so far to say that, you know, even if you're trying to get into the environmental science careers at the undergrad level, I don't even think environmental science is an optimal major. I would say microbiology, biochemistry, you know, that's just if you're trying to work in the natural science aspect of things. But in terms of like, if you're trying to get into the policy aspect of things, it goes the same. Like, you really don't need to major in anything environmental per se. You just have to kind of pursue environmental career opportunities, research opportunities with whatever major that you have. If you already graduated from school, you know, get involved you know, in your local, you know, nonprofit organization that is, you know, concerned of these things, or, you know, even just work at your state council or assembly and just be a politician or a part-time politician that is concerned about, you know, critical and reputable environmental research and the policy that you dictate. And essentially at some point you're going to be that environmental person in that policy room when these mm-hmm. decisions are brought to the table. And, you know, the more people we have in it who are more educated and working and involved in these fields, you know, the better tomorrow that we'll hopefully have, especially, you know, in the Black community. Cause, you know, just like everything, we're underrepresented and we're not at the table enough.
Definitely. And would you say that us as minorities, us as Black people, do we understand the effects our environmental exposures or where our communities lie affect our health and the way that we move through the world and communicate with others? Do we really understand how we're being affected?
I mean, how deep does that rabbit hole go, or how far down you're trying to get to it?
From your experience, you know, with, like, you know, how you've been going through communities or businesses and doing tests and educating people where you can, have you seen that, you know, people tend to understand when you speak to them about the effects of, you know, negative exposures?
I mean, in terms of, you know, the nitty gritty, you know, what's happening at the molecular level of, you know, asbestos exposure in your lungs, or like the natural science concepts, you know, fortunately, no, like in terms of, you know, the Black community, you know, in terms of a large portion of our population, unfortunately, does not have access to the adequate education to be able to get into those details. One thing that we do know, there's no equity. They do know when their children are sick. They do know that they're going to the doctor's office maybe more often than someone on the other side of the tracks. But, you know, that's the only experience that they know. That being said, you know, any neighborhood you go to or any community you go to, I'm sure that there are nonprofit organizations, people from and of those communities who are advocating and well aware and fighting for these things every day. I wish I knew the names of any of these particular organizations off the top of my head at the moment, but, like, I do know that they're out there, you know, even if you're just talking about, like, your local health department, you know, some health departments and some local communities, they're not as affluent, you know, especially if they're in some rural areas that, you know, still happen to have large Black communities, you know, they're not funded adequately enough. And so it's like the staff can tell you the issues that are going on and how, you know, they might not be able to get all the resources and staff that they need to address everything. But your everyday person and your everyday, you know, whether you're talking about a student or an adult, they know when they're sick and they know when there's inequality. But the particular way to either get the funding or even to get the research done to see the further details of these exposures and these ailments, you know, that's what needs to be addressed. And so as it tends to be, we tend to get cut out of the budget, and then, you know,
that's a good way of putting it
enough, you know?
So I want to ask you guys, do you think that when it comes to really implementing change, how do you know when what you're doing is enough versus competing with other organizations for the same little bit of, like, support?
Yeah, that's a sad thing, but I mean, not to get all, you know, economically political about this, but that's, you know, kind of what capitalism is. You know, it's competition, especially in the nonprofit sector, you know. But at least in the nonprofit sector, unfortunately, I mean, private sector especially, but the nonprofit, you know, as for private sector, they're competing for customers. Nonprofit sector is competing for donors. But mm-hmm. considering that nonprofit isn't supposed to be working for profit, I'd like to think that, you know, because we shouldn't be crabs in the barrel. At the end of the day, there's a wealth, a laundry list of endless issues in our communities, especially environmental. You know, it's similar in the education nonprofit sector, because I remember having to canvas for funding for City Air back in the day in the galas. But, you know, in the environmental nonprofit sector as well, you think because there is, you know, these very explicit issues that are known in these communities, that there would be like a coalition, and this is how much funding there is, how many hands on deck do we have of nonprofit environmental organizations? You know, is it possible that, like, while you work on addressing the lead issues here and on our water supply, like, you know, you address, you know, the smog coming out from the factory down the street, and from there, like, we can get more done together than we can against each other. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Maybe there is already like a coalition of that establishes that for local communities, but, you know, it just like, yeah, that sounds so crazy to me that they compete, because, you know, it's not like there's a shortage of work to be done. Mm-hmm. Shortage of funding is one thing, but it's like, I mean, I guess that's where, you know, it comes down to organizations arguing, you know, which issues are more
important
or more harmful. Right. You know, but
because I feel like it inherently isn't, I don't like you, I want this funding. It's more of a, like you said, we are working on this particular issue, I'm getting this so I can get this funding because I'm the front runner for this particular issue. And the other organization is, I'm the front runner for this particular issue, but I do a lot of other things too, just like you. So I'm going to apply for this funding because I'm more likely to get it. But how much more likely would it be that these communities can fix each issue one at a time if it were all of this funding right now fix this particular problem? All of this funding right now fix this particular problem.
So Anthony, I want to ask you, like, given, let's say this is a huge platform, let's say this week we have 1 million listeners and people who download, right? And you can talk to everybody that's part of this community. What is, and with this mindset of everyone, we're all in this together, and we're going to make this a collective effort. What would be one or two things that are like low hanging fruit that people in these communities can do, like right now, to better their quality of life and the environmental health aspect of how they live? Like, what's one or two things they could just do today that could make a huge difference, do you think?
That's something to really think about. One obvious thing immediately coming to mind right now, stay home. You know, we're hearing, you know, the dangers and terrors of coronavirus right now, you know, on our news, that is very much so an environmental issue. Especially, you know, as we were talking about environmental racism and environmental justice, you know, Black people, this, you know, as we're hearing in the news in the past couple of weeks, we've been hit with coronavirus, you know, disproportionately higher. The truth, like, yeah, stay home if you can. But unfortunately, you know, just because socioeconomically speaking, a lot of Black people, you know, we tend to work in jobs where we're essential personnel. Be very careful not to cross-contaminate. You know, as one of the main roles that I had as an environmental health specialist for, you know, the health department, you know, when you're working in like food service safety, you're very just keen to make sure that everyone is washing their hands and making sure not to cross-contaminate. And so, you know, take that same behavior everywhere you go now. Just, you know, treat your entrance, your door entrance like an airlock. You know, you get in, you drop everything on the floor, sanitize everything. You know, wear your mask, don't cough on people. And, you know, we'll get through this, you know, and just take care of yourself. You know, self-care can't be stressed enough also while you're here. But second of all, you know, not to, at least for the second thing I would tell people to do, not to look down or talk down on anyone's beliefs or anything right now. Become very critical of the information that you're getting from online and, you know, even just your local circles, because there's just a lot of, you know, conspiracies that are circulating right now. And, you know, we're in a very critical time right now, directing too much attention towards a conspiracy that, you know, if you don't read into it enough or educate yourself on it enough, and, you know, it's not founded with truth, it's not going to help the critical issues that we have to deal with right now. So I'm not going to name any particular conspiracies at the moment, you know, but just maintain your sanitation and check your sources. That's my two biggest pointers right now in terms of environmental health and safety.
And what sources would you recommend so people don't fall prey to like clickbait or any other type of thing that they see on Instagram, like Shade Room? That's where I get most of my information. catches my eye. I don't watch the news. So what would you say? I think it's very credible, by the way. We don't need to laugh that hard, but let's...
Shade Room?
I think so.
Oh, no. Of course. I follow Shade Room. I follow World Star, you know, that keeps me up there and everything, you know? Like, real talk, yeah. You see the headlines with the red, you know, banister or the red highlighting right. on it, you know you're going to hear some serious information.
Right.
But yeah, you know, not to say, you know, especially being Black in America, I get why people follow conspiracies. We have a very real fear and a very real and valid concern of not being able to trust our government, not being
very
able to
valid. Trust,
you know, like, so I get that, you know. With that being said, listen to the scientists, I guess, of your government, but not even just the scientists of your government. Listen to not just one scientist. I'm not saying don't, you know, read through the conspiracies, but, you know, really, I feel like a lot of people, they get a lot of their information on social media, and because that's all they get, you know, a lot of conspiracies, just because they're easy and the sensational clickbait, they circulate quicker and that becomes a belief. But it's like, while you're getting that and assessing that for yourself, you know, take the time to really learn if it's a fact or myth for anything that you get online. See, read the explanations of how they debunk things, you know, see if it's a government scientist, a university scientist, you know, because that's the thing about science. Like, it's, there's no absolute truth. There's never 100% consensus on what's fact or fiction, but you can kind of get to see, like, all right, what is the topic here? You know, who are the experts? Who are the people that I've been getting it from? You know, to what level of detail do they explain, you know, especially, you know, don't be afraid to learn the natural science explanations on why it is the scientists are saying why this is a real issue, or also when they're disproving some of these things, why is it that it's not the real issue, you know? And so right now, in terms of credible scientists, you know, everyone tends to listen to Dr. Fauci, you know, I'd say he's a pretty valid source at the moment, you know? Trump, he's also a very valid. Okay, I'm kidding. I can't say that. But yeah, there's a it's a skill, you know. But over time, you continually get yourself into checking your information, you know, because that's what the scientists do when they're checking their statistics. So,
and there are environmental science courses on that reference that I made earlier in this podcast. So check those out, people. Yeah. Not you, but the listeners. You too, if you want.
And I agree. We could also even search for our information via the Department of Health for each of your like communities or each of your states. They'd have some valid information at least. And CDC, the CDC will have some shared statistics as well.
Definitely. Yeah, check with your local health department agencies, check with your state health departments, you know, CDC, National Institute of Health, they'll have a lot more,
National
cutting edge research, you know, foods and drugs you're eating, drinking, check the FDA, and the crops that you're buying, check the USDA. They all have just a wealth of scientists. There's just so much
resources. And the information is waiting there for us to collect it. So it's really not for these institutions. There's really not. So I also wanted to ask you, AR, when it comes to the information that, you know, you're collecting and the agencies that you've worked for have collected, how do you think that kind of information that you know now affects how we live day to day? Like, let's think of ourselves as on the other side of COVID-19. Do you think that there are particular things that the Black community should know that would influence the way that we kind of just regularly live in our communities? Do you think we should be doing anything?
I mean, in terms of environmental public health and safety, unfortunately, you know, the water we drink and the air that we breathe is based more on our zip code than our personal choices. But, you know, in terms of, you know, public health or general public health in the Black community, you know, I think you guys have talked about it in your show a lot. But, you know, so much of our health outlooks are based in our diets and our fitness. And so just drink a lot of water, man. you know, unfortunately, like drinking water is like the healthiest thing you can do, but because Black people don't always have the option of the cleanest water, you know, like I get that, you know, so however you can, you know, get a filter to get yourself clean water, drink a lot of it, you know, reduce your sugars, you know, walk, run, exercise, do some strength training, get into some martial arts, but, you know, do what works for you. And it's a real cultural shift that it's up to our generation of millennials and Generation Z to kind of get out of our livelihoods, because otherwise, you know, we can't hand down these same health outlooks for, you know, our next generation. So it's like while we're fighting the political battle that is our environmental health and safety of our communities, like we have to take care of our own health and nutrition in the same way. And hopefully, you know, the coming generations and the ideal Afrofuturistic, you know, world we'll be living in, you know, won't be having to deal with these issues that we and our ancestors have.
Yeah, I think that's definitely good advice.
One, I just want to do a shout out to everybody that is an essential worker or healthcare person at this time that's still working to make sure that this society doesn't crumble beneath our feet, keeping the water on, keeping the water clean, keeping people sick and comforted. And for those that are checking on our elderly people, buying groceries and just going out their way to do what they can to make things easier for other people that probably don't have the resources or just the physical well-being to be able to take care of themselves at a time. I like that people are just stepping up to the plate to make sure that our fellow man is also, that they can just get through this. I think there's been a lot of loss, but I feel like there's also been a lot of good things that came from this where people can show their human side, which unfortunately, you know, this is a situation that has to come from, but it's a reminder that we are capable of doing it even after we get through this. Anthony, I have one more question for you, okay? Before we go, I want to take a bus down to DC when this is over. What's a good place to eat over there?
Man.
Yeah, I have to say the hard question for last, because, you know, I'm not trying to stump you in the first one.
Shout out my girlfriend in here for this. She's a real food aficionado when it comes to these questions. Get a Nashville hot chicken or honey butter sandwich. It's off the chain. It kills Popeye's.
What's the name of the place?
Oh, it kills the Popeye's.
Good Popeye's sandwich. I said it. Shots fired. Nah.
blow.
Roaming Roosters is this fried chicken sandwich place in Northeast DC. It has fried chicken with the secret ingredient in their Nashville hot chicken seasoning. If you ever had hot chicken, it's like just a red, super seasoned, spicy chicken, right? But what they put as the red powder in the seasoning, the secret ingredient, is what's called berbere. The owner of Roman Rooster is Ethiopian, and so he put that seasoning in there, and it's the best Nashville hot chicken or hot chicken sandwich I've had from a restaurant. So I say that, or Savers Food Hall. It's one of the first Black owned food halls in America, I think. I think there's other Black owned food halls in Chicago, but they have some really good chicken waffles, and they have what else? I don't know. Those are the two places that popped up in my head, because those are my two favorites that I keep going to right now, and they're Black owned. So
hey man, heard it first. I'd love to check it out. AR, thanks for coming on the show. This is dope. Hope hopefully you can definitely come on again. You know, I feel like there's so much more that we could have talked about at this time. And thank you guys for listening. I hope you like the show. This is Langston Jules, Paper Made and AR. If you liked it, please subscribe to our podcast with whatever button, when on whatever platform that you're looking at. Also give us 5 stars. If you'd like to also be on the show, definitely you can hit us up on Instagram at Black Hypothesis or our email at blackhypothesis@gmail.com. This was great. If you have any suggestions or anything else you think we'd like to cover, we are very open to any other suggestions that may come our way. So AR, thanks again. That's dope. I'm definitely checking out that place.